Reading from the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, chapter, part 1, text 41, Shina Vritir Abhijatasyeva Maner Grihitri Grihana Krayeshu Tatsta Tadanjanata Samapati. Samapati, complete absorption of the mind, when it's free from its vrittis, occurs when the mind becomes just like a transparent jewel, taking the form of whatever object is placed before it, whether the object be the knower, the instruments of knowledge, or the objects of knowledge. Om Jnana Timurandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Taksuran Mulatam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Mancha Kalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Shindhu Bhayevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namah Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaur Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ramo Hare Ramo Rama Rama Hare Hare. So greetings from Vasant Falls. It's actually Stuyvesant Falls, but I took out the sty and left Vasant, means spring. Give it a little bit of a spiritual name. And it's a farming community, actually. Krishna Kumari, one devotee who lives down the block, she told me that Columbia County, where Stuyvesant Falls is located, has more farmland than the whole state of Massachusetts. And it's situated, I mean, we're about maybe the next block over. There's a huge waterfall, really very, very powerful. So it's kind of a, I guess, a nice place to stay during the summer. And although it's a kind of a rural place, it's got a real nice progressive type element. I guess a lot of people from the city and those type of people kind of, you know, somehow moved up here and tried to make their way. Also, there's a famous Waldorf school where it's one of the only places in America where you can get authorized raw milk. It's quite a nice, it's turned out to be quite a nice spiritual community. Here I'm staying in a barn that's been renovated by Sachi Sutta, who owns a record company, and his record company also now just started a label called Mantrology, which signs kirtan bands. So it's just become a very nice place to stay for me when I'm not traveling. And today was the 44th birthday of Sachi Sutta. So after the yoga class, very successful yoga class right above me, then I'm probably going to explain why I'm probably not going to be teach the class with the clarity I would like, perhaps. But we just had a Mexican, gourmet Mexican feast. There's a few barns and some other people could stay. So one person, two people who are staying yoga are staying here. And one is Jamuna. She's born into the Krishna movement and she's studying yoga in a teacher training near here. So she lives here also. And the Balaram Chandra, who is Radhanath Swami's personal servant for quite a few years. And he cooked. He's an excellent cook. In fact, he's probably going to take over the restaurant in the sanctuary. Actually, he is. That's going to be his service. He's excellent cook, and he's also from a Mexican family. So I don't know. See, the process of bhakti is different because you can contact the objects of the senses, but in a way that they don't make impressions of selfishness. When the food is offered to God in love, then you take it as God's prasadam, mercy, or remnants. And then the taste of the food is mixed with the conception that the object of your love, God, has also enjoyed this. So it's a different, it's like when a mother cooks for a child with love, she may taste the food, but her taste of the food is with the consciousness of love, how my child has enjoyed. So, yeah. So another interesting thing that's out is, and thank you all for following along with me through these Yoga Sutras. I've learned a lot, and I've just compiled it, which is going to be, it's probably, I think, already out on my website, wavesofdevotion.com, but I worked for the last month putting the basics of yoga psychology in a very practical way, and I wrote a 20-page paper and worked hard on it, and I really liked the way it came out in a very, very practical way, explaining all the principles of the mind and their modern and their contemporary application. Another thing that came out, this class was by the mercy of Professor Edwin Bryant, a very wonderful person and a scholar, a devotee, a yogi. And he wrote a translation and commentary of the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, and he was kind enough to give me the manuscript over a year ago before it was even published. But now when I see the published copy, it's beautiful. It's beautiful, it's crystal clear, and the foreword is written by BKS Iyengar. He said, "I congratulate you on your lucid commentary of the Yoga Sutras. I've appreciated your commentary quoting the traditional commentators, Vyas, Vachaspati, Misra, Shankara, Bhojaraj, Vigyan Bhikshu, and Hariharananda, and it reads well. You've presented it in simple and fluent language, which I'm sure will be easily understandable to readers. As you are dedicating it to the teachers of yoga, I'm sure your book will provide the readers with plenty of knowledge so that they may grasp the philosophy beyond the subject and move towards the higher aspects of life in their sadhana practice." It's also interesting in it, I read in the, just to share you a little bit with it. By the way, it's you can get it, it's North Point Press. It seems to be a division of Macmillan because they sent me an advanced copy, Professor Bryant, and I got a card from someone named Alice Baker. It says Macmillan on Fifth Avenue. So I guess they want me to sell the books. They gave me a free copy. But I think B.S. Iyengar says, and it's a lot, and it's a beautiful introduction on the history of yoga. I mean, he's a great scholar, but he's down to earth and very, very clear. By the way, also, Mahamuni, who's usually on the Sangha, when Mahamuni was going to Rutgers, Mahamuni lived with Professor Bryant and rented out an apartment, and very, very reasonable, very, very reasonable. And he also studied under him, too. And I know him when he first came to Spiritual Life in Vrindavan in 1982. I just wanted, he said, this is BKS Iyengar. He said, therefore, the practice of Pratyahara in Ashtanga Yoga is to be formed with these four legs. Okay. It is this combination only that leads the yogi towards the highest state in bhakti marg, the sharanagati marg, total dependence on Ishvara God. This is how I understand and practice the Ashtanga of the sage Pantanjali. In the back, I hope this is all relevant, but it's got great things because it's also got a list of just all the verses directly. It has chapter summaries. This is nice. This is a part about Ishvara that was written. It says, oh boy, what the hell? This is by a scholar he quotes called Coleman. According to Coleman, Pantanjali's low-key approach to Ishvara was diplomatic, the consequence of maneuvering within the contours of certain later Sankhya traditions that had become dominant in his day. Srila Prabhupada also talks about two Sankhyas. So the original Sankhya, accepted historically within our tradition, the original Kapila, there was two Kapilas, but the original Kapila was theistic. And later there was a strand of Sankhya that became prominent at the time of Pantanjali that was atheistic, or, well, just didn't believe in God. And so he's saying that he's theistic, but he's a little bit diplomatic. So he writes, we believe that Pantanjali Yoga is essentially theistic. But as G.R.F. Ubahama has proved, the Pantanjali doctrine of the Supreme Lord had to express itself in terms of a philosophical school, the Sankhya school, which had no room for God. The Pantanjali doctrine of the Supreme Lord is the outcome of two different milieus, that of the existential experience of God of the yogis and that of the atheistic conceptualization of the Sankhya doctrine. Pantanjali made use of the existing Sankhya doctrine and was therefore compelled to make use of tenets foreign to Sankhyan thinking and a vocabulary proper to that system. In 124, we presented our position that Ishvara's identity and role when interacting with the Purusha within the realms of Prakriti cannot be extracted from the greater theistic landscape of Pantanjali's day. But what of Ishvara's interaction with the liver? Okay, this will, you'll have to read it yourself. So what I'm going to do today is I'm just going to read the chapter summary to where we're up to from his book, and then I'm going to go into the verse for today. In terms of this chapter summary, they're very, very short. So see, after some of you, quite a few have been studying this whole time, if it makes sense. So chapter one, the chapter begins by introducing and defining yoga. This is followed by a discussion of the two possible options of awareness, basically material and spiritual. Then a description of the vrittis, the fluctuations of the mind, and then how to control the vrittis by practice and dispassion. That's he gives the, that's 12 to 16. Then comes the division of samadhi into sampragata and asampragata. So basically, there was a definition of yoga, yoga chitta vritti nirodha, then yoga, then chitta, and then vritti, then nirodha were described, and then the result was described, which is samadhi at two different levels. And then how to attain these after the discussion of other states that might resemble it. So Ishvara is then introduced as the easy method of attaining samadhi, 23, along with his nature, 24 to 26, it gave the nature of God, and the chanting of his name, 27 to 29. The chapter describes the distractions of the mind and their accompanying effects, 30 and 31, the different, you know, idleness, sloth, and prescribes meditation on any object to combat them with various examples presented, 32 to 40. So that's where we left off. It described that, you know, Ishvara Pranidhan, that you can meditate on God, and this will be the effect. And then it described the different distractions of the mind that can be destroyed by this type of meditation. And the basic distractions of the mind are just further categorizations of the vrittis. The vrittis are the fluctuations of the mind that are distorting the pure state of the mind that can perfectly reflect the soul and help you understand yourself. So, and then it describes meditation. So if you want to destroy these, then there's different types of meditations. And we described many of the different types from particular type of pranayama to meditating on a person who is selfless. And there was something about dreams and sleep. And there were various types of meditations. But basically, they all had one commonality, that if you can focus the mind on one thing, then you'd be neglecting the multifarious distractions, the fluctuations that distort the mind. You can think, you know, of how many things are just flying through your mind. You know, desires and hurt and anxieties and just a multitude of distractions. I mean, even in 1 minute, how many things are we thinking, even beyond our control? So that strategy of just focusing on one object steadies the mind by the neglect of all the other distractions. And basically, this prescription of meditation can basically be on any object, because if the meditation on any object will be the destruction or pacification of all the other fluctuations of the mind. And then, of course, in this particular type of path, once you get to that pure meditation, then you know that last thought of let me remain fixed, and the soul abides in its own awareness. So now we kind of come again to samadhi, and there were divisions of samadhi that were mentioned. And now, and today, we're going to discuss the first division of samadhi, which is called, and samadhi means what? When the vrittis, when you're free from the vrittis, you develop this complete absorption. But this complete absorption has different stages. of and that was mentioned previous. This is 40 verse 41, but it was mentioned in verse 117 that there were different stages of samadhi called vitarka, vichara, ananda, asmita. So this first stage of vitarka, is being described, and that's called sampatti. And there's two divisions of sampatti. One is savitarka and one is nirvitarka. And this is, we're discussing the first is kind of with a meditation on a physical object. I'm going to get to the purport. I think it'll become more clear. I'm not satisfied yet. But anyway, what's happening now is we've come upon again, because the first chapter really is discussing yoga. Not really how to get there, but it's describing what it is. And then the next chapter will be how you prepare yourself, Ashtanga yoga and Kriya yoga and these type of things to bring you to this point of yoga where the mind can be steady. So now, basically, we're coming towards the end of the chapter, and it's going to be a little bit of an in-depth study of the state of samadhi when the vrittis or the fluctuations of the mind are stilled. And it's a progressive depth of kind of meditation. So Patanjali has, he's just has considered various objects that can be used to support the mind in meditation. Now he returns to what is samadhi, dealing with the stages within this meditative state, irrespective of the object, because it's a psychosomatic process. So if you can focus the mind, and it's a very, very powerful thing because it describes how when the mind becomes focused, it becomes one with the object that it's focusing. And the mind has a nature to penetrate into the very essence of the object that one is focusing. So when I was thinking about this today, I was describing, what if you're meditating on mantras? And that's what your mind is thinking about. This is just even from just a pure metaphysical platform. We're going to be reading how the mind it can become one with the object that it's meditating on. So what is the object of your meditation? Is the mantra, Hare Krishna mantra. To always think of God in every aspect. That's how we were trained in the process of Krishna consciousness. It's no joke. When you understand and you understand how the mind works, you can understand how attuned Srila Prabhupada was to the way the mind functions, but with the objective of spiritualizing the mind in relationship to God, to Krishna. Of always thinking of Krishna, what happens to it? The mind takes the shape of Krishna. The mind takes the shape of the object it is meditating, and the mind penetrates into the very essence of that object. So, I'm getting inspiration in different ways. This is just the science of the mind, but I'm getting the inspiration in my own spiritual life to be so serious in my own meditation. It's a practice. It's practice and detachment. When you think of the yogis, you don't think that, it's all just a bowl of cherries. So, of course, when you meditate on God, it's easier because there's a reciprocation that we already described. So I'm going to read a little bit. When the mind is free from all distractions in the form of vrittis, it becomes like a pure crystal. So this is described in the verse. And this is a classic, the word is anjanata, colored. It's like a crystal becomes colored by any object presented to it. So it's saying in this advanced meditation, although it's the beginning stage of samadhi, but still it's an advanced meditation samadhi, that the mind assumes the form of the object. It's kind of the nature of the mind. So if the crystal is near a red flower, then the crystal becomes red. So this describes, in this type of meditation, the mind free from other fluctuations, then it's impacted by a particular object, and the mind becomes, you know, focused and completely still. Patanjali here states that the mind can reflect and assume the form of any object. So here it says the different objects that the mind can become. So an external object made of gross elements, graya. So you meditate on a candle, the mind will become like that. The very instruments of knowledge, that word was used, called the what was that word in the Sanskrit? Grahana. So the instruments, the sense organs, or the intelligence, the mind, even its purest and most subtle function. And then there's a concept here that the mind, somehow or other, the nature of the mind is, it says, you know, the sense objects can't perceive the mind, the senses can perceive the mind. Of course, it's consciousness, but the instrument of the senses the gross sense objects can't perceive the senses, but the senses are viewing the mind. The senses are viewing the object. And the senses can't see the mind sees the senses, and then you go to the soul. And therefore, to understand the soul, you can't understand the soul with the mind. The mind, through the instrument of the mind, one can understand the senses. Through the instrument of the senses, one can understand the sense object. And the soul can understand what's grosser, which is the mind. So the mind can't understand the soul, but the mind in its pure state can serve as a reflective agent, a mirror by which the soul can see itself. The gross and subtle elements evolve out of citta in Sankhya, and thus the mind, being more subtle than its evolutes, and indeed their very essence, can pervade them. This includes not only the objects of knowledge, that is, sense objects, but also, as Patanjali indicates, the sense organs themselves, and even the faculty of intelligence. The mind can not only internally mold its own nature into the form of an object, but can actually penetrate into the object's very essence. In a sense, it becomes the object by merging with it, and thereby gains ultimate insight into its deepest nature. So somehow or other, at this kind of stage of samadhi, the mind is somehow can become completely focused on the essence of anything. And this is a particular stage of samadhi. I'm seeing as I read it, there's questions myself that I perhaps didn't understand as quickly as well as I thought when I was studying this. It says, only Purusha, only the soul can know itself, but mind can, however, redirect awareness back to its own original source and thus indirectly reflect the soul, just as a mirror can reflect the face. In other words, the soul can become aware of itself by means of the reflective nature of the pure sattvic mind. Anyway, this is called sampatti. Samadhi is a more general term, and sampatti is a stage of samadhi. It's a stage of samadhi where there's complete mental identification with an absorption in an object, which can only occur when all other vrittis have been still and the mind is without distraction. So in other words, there becomes such a complete mental identification with an object, because you're focused on that object, that all other vrittis are dispelled. So this is actually the first stage of samadhi. It's a complete depth of concentration. In other words, you're meditating, but all of a sudden your meditation breaks into this samadhi, which is an extreme depth where the mind is meditating on an object until the mind becomes practically one with that object and enters into the essence of that object. So you can imagine the depth of that kind of meditation and how sattvic the mind becomes. Even when we're chanting the Hare Krishna mantra, we're chanting, and there's so many vrittis, there's so many fluctuations of thought, but as we're chanting, we're hearing only the mantra, only the mantra. And if we focus more and more and more, then the mantra becomes, we should have this experience to some degree. The mantra becomes louder. Somehow we enter into a depth of the mantra. Somehow initially we're hearing it, it's something external. But as we're chanting more and more, the mantra is becoming more and more one with our mind. So in this type of meditation, eventually the object becomes completely one with the mind. And the mind is just absorbed. It's entering even to the inner essence of that object. And all other vrittis are destroyed. So this is sampatti, the first stage of samadhi. We'll do one more verse for today. In this stage, savitarka samapti, samadhi's absorption with physical awareness, is intermixed with the notion of word, meaning, and idea. So this samapati samadhi, it has two divisions. We're studying now savitarka. There's nirvitarka and savitarka. And savitarka means with some physical awareness. And the physical awareness means word. You're cognizant of the name of something that you're meditating on somehow. And the jnana, the conception of it, and then artha, here it says meaning, but it's also defined as the actual physical object. So So Vyas takes a cow as his example of an object of meditation to illustrate the nature of the samadhi indicated by Savitarka. Nirvitaka, Sarvitaka, with physical awareness, without physical awareness. So with, so it has two, the artha, the actual physical object, and cow, the one syllable word, the shabda. Linguistic indicator can fairly clearly. In other words, you're meditating, and you know you're meditating on the object, and within your mind is the idea or conception of it, and it has a particular. Awareness, what the word is for that. So your meditation on the object is mixed with your conception or idea of it, with the conception of it and the name of it. It's mixed with that. But there becomes another level of samadhi where you're experiencing the object purely. Without any mental conception. In other words, you're actually experiencing the object in your meditation, unmixed with any idea or conception of it. The object itself is coming unfiltered. Right now, when we are meditating on something, we have an idea or conception which we superimpose on the object, and a certain name of that object, which can change according to languages. So our meditation is with some form of superimposition. So that's some vitarka samadhi. And then there's a higher level of this initial state of samadhi called samapati. They're both samapati. But there's a higher level of meditation where... you're meditating on the object without gyan, without conceptualization or name. You're purely experiencing the object itself. I think he explains it pretty... In other words, the yogi's experience of the object is still subtly tinged with an awareness of what the object is called and with the memory or idea corresponding to that object. So... In other words, an object comes, we search the consciousness for a samskara or mental imprint of that object, which may be objective or not, just like certain people look at things in different ways. It's the same object, but because we're superimposing our previous experience on it, we're perceiving the object through... an awareness of what that object is called and a memory of that idea of it. So in conventional experience as well as in the non-conventional experience of the Samvitarka Samapati of this sutra, the experience of an object is mixed up with mental images in the form of words and ideas. So your meditation is mixed up with that. In this sense, direct experience of the object in its own right on its own ground of being is tainted by the imposition of conceptual thought on it. So you still stop the vrittis and are meditating on something, but there's an imposition of your conceptual thought on it. And evidently there's a higher level of samadhi where the artha, the actual object itself, you're absorbed into without any superimposition of your mental conceptions. Vachaspati Mishra calls this type of samadhi lower perception. This awareness of the object's word, meaning, and idea is not to be confused with the vrittis discussed in the opening sutra of the text. The yogi is not deliberating or reasoning about the object in any kind of analytical or intellectual rambling fashioned at the level of discursive thought, nor is he or she consciously activating a samskara to recognize the object, since that would involve the activation and presence of vritti. We are on the level of samadhi here, where all vrittis have been killed. Nonetheless, the yogi's complete absorption on the object still includes some kind of intuitive level of awareness or spontaneous insight as to the object's name and meaning. In other words, the subconscious samskara of recognition are not fully latent or inactive. Anyway, this is something subtle. Somehow, there's no vrittis, but there's still some scars. Somehow the mind's not fluctuating, but still, without the fluctuations of the thought, there's some. I don't really understand the difference here. I'm going to have to think of it, but there is a difference between some scars and vrittis. There's impressions, latent impressions of objects, and then there's thoughts of them. But so somehow or other, in this type of meditation, maybe the thoughts are very minimal, or there's some kind of intuitive understanding. In other words, you're not activating the mind in some way. Somehow it's still at a very intuitive level. I don't understand it fully. We'd have to get into the concept of, why these are not vrittis of thoughts when you perceive the object. But at the very, very least, the mind is not deliberating and fluctuating, etc. It has almost an intuitive conception of this object, but still based on your latent intuitive impressions of samskaras. Subhitarka might be better understood in comparison with the next stage of Nivitarka, described in the next sutra, as when, in contrast, the object stands out in its own right without being conflated with the conventional terminologies of language that might refer to it with any idea or meaning it may generate. Indeed, the commentators begin their discussion of the subject here. Nivitarka means non-conceptual, or more accurately, super-conceptual. This occurs when the yogi's chitta has been purged of any memory awareness of what the object is and what it's called. So at this stage, there's not even any samskaras of the object. So what you're experiencing is the object itself without any prejudice or preconceived conception. So it's almost, what did he say? The object stands at its own right. Mishra states that this type of object awareness is real yoga perception because conceptual, artificial notions and names are not superimposed upon the object. After all, any word can denote the object cow if socially agreed upon. And of course, the object is referred to by many different terms in various languages. And the idea of cow is a mental construction, a samskaric imprint on the chitta. Neither word, meaning, nor idea is the real cow. Actually, as the commentaries point out, conflating word, meaning, and object can be considered a type of imagination because these three distinct things, a conventionally agreed upon sound for an object, a samskaric memory imprint of the object and the chitta, the actual physical object itself are being conflated as if they were one thing. Anyway, I'm not sure about that. Anyway, in Nivitarka Samapati, the object itself stands forth in its own right, free of designation or mental image. So anyway, this is basically in yoga. It's experiential. There's some experience of this object as it is, without any super imposition, and that's Nivatarka Samapatti, and we just described Savitarka Samapatti. Okay, are there any questions? Anybody like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, please accept my humble obeisances.
Hare Krishna, Amir.
I couldn't help thinking of the story, and I don't remember which devoted personality it was who was meditating on boiling milk, and then and then actually had gotten so into the meditation that he burned himself.
There
was an actual burn on his hand or arm or somewhere, and is that kind of what we're talking about?
Well, let's see. Well, I mean, that's another concept. The concept is when you're doing devotional service, you can order a real object or a mental object, but the mental object is also real.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a different form of the object. You know, either way, you're perceiving the object from outside, or you have an imprint of the object. So you can meditate in your mind, or you can do Manasa Puja. It's recommended in Bhakti Sandarbha that
mm-hmm.
you can do mental meditation of an object. You can do devotional service in the mind. And for example, if you have a deity and you're just going out for a day, you know, and you really can't pack the deities and then take the deities and then worship and unpack, just like Bhakti Vishwambhara Madhava Maharaj has elaborate worship, but he practically builds his own altar every day. So he was just coming in for one day, so in the morning he couldn't unpack everything, pack everything, so he did Manasa Puja.
Mm-hmm.
And that's recommended in the Shastra. And it's from our understanding, you can offer things mentally to God. And it's not just that you're not offering anything, but you actually are offering something mentally, because what's accepted is the devotion, and you're actually offering something, because thoughts are also matter. They're subtle matter. But when you're, and therefore, that particular story is that because God reciprocates with that devotion. So it actually becomes a reality. So in that particular story, the devotee was cooking the sweet rice, and the sweet rice, to be offered, it has to be cool. In general, although I heard hot or cold, but generally we understand it has to be cool. So he, in his meditation, he put his finger in it. But he was such a deep meditator that God was accepting it, and therefore his finger was burned. It's the same thing in terms of worshiping the deity. The deity is a manifestation of the absolute reality. Just like there's Shabda Brahman, there's Daru Brahman. Brahman, or the absolute reality, can appear in sound, he can appear in wood or some substance. So when you're worshiping the deity, if you are, if you have love, the deity will actually be hungry. If you have love, the deity will actually be cold. It will reciprocate with your service. If it just manifests as Aishvarya, as power, then what kind of service can one perform?
Right.
Because so the deity will actually respond, and therefore person in that consciousness, if it's cold in his room and he loves the deity will actually be cold and will require a blanket. And if you don't feed the deity will be hungry. In other words, God will reciprocate in that way, and therefore, in the advanced meditation of that particular Brahmin, God is reciprocating. And therefore, in his meditation, he put his finger in the sweet rice, and he burnt his finger because it was still hot, and when we woke up, it was still burnt. But this is another thing, that the absolute reality also, we described before in many instances, the first thing in any spiritual practice is shraddha, or faith. And then from faith becomes vigor, or becomes enthusiasm. So there has to be some type of faith. And therefore, to help the practitioner in his spiritual endeavor, when faith is needed to the sincere practitioner, then God will manifest in particular ways appropriate to that devotee's level of realization. So one way that God can manifest is in dreams. It's kind of a realm where God can actually come, in a realm that we can perceive. So he may come in dreams. So in the same way, I think this is just about God instilling faith in the devotee, that his love and service was accepted in the subtle form. And how does he know it was accepted in the subtle form? Because when, out of love, he was testing the sweet rice to see that it would be at a proper temperature offering, his finger was burnt. So I'm not sure if that's, it's kind of similar.
It fits into any of these yoga categories, yeah.
What?
It seems to be something much more elevated than the...
No, it's not much more elevated. It's just a different type of thing. I don't know what... This is level of samadhi. Certainly that devotee was on a samadhi, but this is also a different type of... this is a different, as I mentioned before, when you get to the level of samadhi, it's different in the bhakti path, the type of samadhi that one achieves, and it's different in the yoga path.
In the yoga path, yeah.
So it's a different type of samadhi, and because in when it's described in Bhakti Sandarbha, what the samadhi of bhakti is samadhi means that one is not cognizant of the outside world, but the meditation of the bhakta is the pastimes and lila of Ishvara, of God, is manifest, and he's meditating on that, and he's not cognizant of the world. So in that lila, in the exchange of rasa or love, he may experience different emotions. So he's not cognizant of the outside. So sometimes he may be laughing in relationship to the lila of pastime. Sometimes he may be crying. So it's actually a different type of realm. And I think this is sometimes what people don't understand. That's why you have to have an objective or goal. Because according to your objective or goal, that's where you'll attain. If you're just dealing with the mind and controlling the mind to reveal the spiritual reality, the spiritual reality is also manifest according to your desire or relationship, because it's very, very dynamic. So in the path of bhakti, when you have that kind of spiritual objective to have lila and serve God and that type of thing, and that's what manifests. So it's a different type of samadhi, but the general concept of samadhi is a deep absorption. And the symptom of a deep absorption is that there's not cognizance of anything else. But in our deep absorption, the absorption is on the exchange between God and his energies, which manifest as lila. So I think this is, it's a little bit different, but I'm sure there's corresponding, because what it's listing is from the very beginning, from Ahimsa, the first, if it's Astanga Yoga, which will be described in the next chapter, from the very, very beginning of Ashtanga Yoga, the very, very beginning, which is Yam, which begins with Ahimsa. It's a progressive state. It's a progression of a deeper and deeper and deeper meditations, deeper and deeper and deeper. Your focus and your absorption becomes greater and greater and greater and greater in each state. So this is listing different levels of absorption. It's different levels of absorption. So the first level is where you become absorbed in the object and you have physical awareness of it according to your samskaras. And so there's some superimposition on the object from your mind, but not the part of your mind which is at the platform of thought, but the part of your mind that has these subtle impressions. But somehow or other, there's some meaning, conception, some word imposed on it. But it's an absorption. And all the vrittis, all the fluctuations of the mind are completely still. Then, at this first stage, then it's without any imposition. And somehow you're absorbed directly in the object itself. So there are different absorptions in Vaishnav type conception and samadhi also. Okay, thank you, Amir.
Thank you, Maharaj. One more question. What is the title of that book now?
It's very simple. It's The Yoga Sutras of Patanjali by Edwin F. Bryant. And it's Northport Press.
Yeah,
I may ask Rati Krishna to order, I think if you order 15 or 20 copies, it's half price.
Oh, wow.
So if you wait a week, I'm just going to ask Rati to order some, and then we'll make them available at a cheaper price, okay?
Great, that's terrific.
Okay, thank you
so much. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hi, Krishna Maharaj. This is Gail.
Gail, Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
How are you doing?
I'm good.
Okay. Are you coming on the first?
Of course.
Okay.
If Krishna allows.
Okay, it's going to be really, really nice. We're going to have Julan Yatra. And also we'll have two lectures, Gail, by Yagya and myself.
Yeah.
Okay?
Okay. Yeah, please order the book.
Okay, I'll get to Rati right after this, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hi, Krishna Maharaj, it's Karunika.
Karunika, thank you for being on all the way from New Zealand. Yeah.
Thank you for being there, Maharaj.
Okay. We'll see you in Vrindavan soon, right?
Oh, I hope so.
In October. Oh, thank you. Okay. Anybody else like to say hello? I think what's going to be interesting about this, after we get through with samadhi, we're going to get back to some very, very practical stuff on Kriya Yoga and Ashtanga Yoga and the different stages, and then I think it'll become a little bit more relevant. Okay, well, thank you all for coming on today. Thank you.